So warm welcome to everybody, especially if you are a newcomer to St. Edward's or to these Tuesday talks. You're very welcome. We usually have, certainly during term times, but at other times too, we have series of talks on a weekday afternoon, then now on Tuesdays from 5:30 to 6:30 in St. Edward's, to which everyone is welcome. And when I'm doing them, I tend to look a little bit about literature and imaginative arts, and particularly to think about the nature of imagination, the role of it. I have a passion for making the case for imagination as a truth-bearing faculty and as complementary to and needing to be restored back in balance with faculties of reason. So it won't surprise you to know that I'm interested in William Blake. And I've often alluded to Blake, and both Fraser and I have done so in sermons. We're fortunate to live in a place that at the Fitzwilliam Museum has a really good Blake collection. So I thought it'd be good to dedicate a month, as it were, here at St. Edward's to exploring Blake together. And that's exactly what we're going to do. If you get the current newsletter, the October one, you'll see all the dates for these talks set out. What I said in that, I've called the whole thing William Blake ahead of his time, ahead of ours, Everybody loves to say that William Blake was ahead of his own time, and when he had a great, you know, when Yeats discovered him and published and republished him, you know, Yeats saw him as a great lost prophet and predecessor, and so saw him anticipating all the things that Yeats wanted to do at the turn of the 20th century. And then, of course, he was rediscovered massively in the 60s, not just by, as it were, hippies and flower children, but by all kinds of people who were trying to borrow a phrase of Blake's, which then became one of the great phrases of the 60s, who were trying to cleanse the doors of perception. And the beat poets picked him up. Allen Ginsberg was a great devotee, and there was a great poetry revival going on in London, partly inspired by Ginsberg. There was a meeting in the Albert Hall in the 60s, one of them called the Children of Albion, a Blake phrase, and a whole series of poets and poetry were launched from that. So Blake has had an extraordinary series of connections and revivals, and at each point, those who've discovered Blake and found in him a striking prophet and somebody relevant to their own age have always said he was ahead of his time, by which they meant they thought he was equal to their own, and they wanted to congratulate Blake on agreeing with them, really, which is what we do when we say people are ahead of their time. We say, oh, look, they had opinions that we like too. But one of the extraordinary things about Blake, which everybody, and especially the great Blake experts, you know, the Edmonds and Kathleen Raines of this world will say, is that there is still a great deal of Blake that we don't understand. I think we understand more and more. I think we understand more of Blake than anything that his contemporaries did. But I think there's a vast hinterland of Blake that is still kind of opaque to us. And I'd like to suggest that that may be because we should have a bit of humility here, and we ought to think that as well as being ahead of his own time, he may actually still be ahead of ours. He may be saying things which we are not ready to hear yet. And sometimes the most exciting things in Blake are where you feel you're on the glimmering of an understanding and you think, I'm almost getting this, and I need to live a little bit longer, and I need to open my mind and cleanse my vision and raise my consciousness, and I'll get a little bit more of this. There's a tremendous sense for me in Blake of how much he still has to give, how much he still has to say. And in the final session of these, I want to talk about Blake as a prophet and about what Blake may come to mean to us as we move through both the crises, but also the opportunities and perhaps the new ways of relating to the cosmos and to the inner world that may be coming towards us in the 21st century. We may find Blake has got there ahead of us. So whilst I will say, and I'm going to do that particularly today, a little bit about Blake in his own time, I want to talk also about Blake in ours, and Blake, as it were, looking ahead, looking over what the scientists, the physicists so happily call the event horizon, trying to look beyond that. So what I've said is, I've called it Blake ahead of his time, ahead of ours, question mark. I'm looking at him as poet and prophet and visionary, But I'm trying to look at how Blake can help us face the future. Do come forward. There are seats at the back and seats here if you can risk the gesticulations. So today is an introduction and an overview. Next week, I thought it'd be good to get to grips with one text, as it were, and see something whole. So we're going to start with the most well-known and in some ways the most accessible, but still highly challenging text of Blake's, which is the Songs of Innocence and Experience, originally published separately and really quite a number of years apart from one another, but clearly meant now to be read together. They're in conversation with one another at all times, the Songs of Innocence and Experience. So that's the text we're going to look at next week. If you have a chance to look at it, it's all online. Blake would have loved the digital age in some respects, although he would have had severe criticisms of it in others. What he would have liked was the idea that you could get vivid image and word together. He really, as you'll see from what I've got here, and I'll say a word about this display in a minute, he was somebody who wanted, in the manner of the medieval manuscripts, to have image and word in constant conversation with one another and challenging one another. And of course, the web allows you to do that. But in any case, you can read everything by Blake on the web and you can see a wonderful gallery of images. So if you want to find the Songs of Innocence and Experience, you know, Google will take you there. Though if you're able to get books, there's a wonderful, there are a whole series of editions of it. This is a particularly treasured copy of mine, which my mother gave me, actually as a present when I first came up here to this university in the late 70s. And it's by it's the Trianon Press, and it's a complete facsimile in the size, as it would have been, of the Songs of Innocence and Experience. And by a happy chance, and I'm very grateful to Anna, who messaged me today and told me about this, I was going to do my best to juggle with a sort of creaky laptop and pass some images in round. And she said, did you know that in David's bookshop, they're selling off huge printer's sheets with beautiful printings of Blake images? And the Trianon Press, which was set up specifically in Paris to do beautiful reproductions, you know, facsimiles almost of Blake books. I don't know if they've gone under or whatever, but somehow or another, David's next door has acquired these printer sized sheets, and they've got three of them. I just bought all three, but they have a whole stack of them. They must have been intended for editions of the books that were never printed. And, you know, I bought like all three for £15 or something. Quite extraordinary. And they've got some smaller ones outside as well. So you can, I've brought these here, but they've got them for a while. So not that I want to do plugs for local businesses, but it seems to me an extraordinary opportunity that they're there. I mean, they're really beautiful, you can frame them. I'll talk about those a little bit. But I hope this sheer vividness of colour, this fluidity of line, this movement between image and written word. He didn't, when he produced his own printed books, he didn't, as it were, use type and, you know, movable type and set into the blocks and printed down as a book would have been then. He actually, in handwriting, engraved the poems in a special method that he called a relief etching, which he had himself invented, and then the outlines. And then he went back and he and his wife Catherine hand-coloured everything. He sold very, very few of these books. They were quite difficult to make. They were slow to make. They were almost like a reinvention of medieval illuminated manuscripts. I think I saw somewhere that Blake may have sold a total, given all his works, of perhaps 200 copies of his poetry in his own day. So if there are any poets or authors here who are troubled by small sales, you know, take hope. Now, of course, you know, there are massive and beautiful critical editions available, and these are many times reproduced. So next week will be the Songs of Innocence and Experience. October the 16th, what might seem, or would seem certainly to some of Blake's fans from the 60s and 70s, almost odd, I'm going to do a session on Blake and Jesus. Now, Blake, as we will see in a minute, was a blazing, flaming, righteously angry and prophetic critic of the church and of the established church in particular. We'll look at, I mean, just words that spring to mind immediately is his lines for the little chimney sweep. Mother, dear mother, the church is cold, but the alehouse is healthy and pleasant and warm. Besides, I can tell where I am used well. But, of course, his critiques went much, much more deeply than that. You know, the walls of the brothel are built with the bricks of religion, for example. He saw a lot of religiosity and false piety as part of what he called the mind-forged manacles. So it was been fashionable for a while to, as it were, emphasise and quote Blake's strictures against the contemporary abuses of the church and read them as though that was Blake dismissing all religions or Blake particularly dismissing or attacking Christianity. I want to show in the third session, the session on Blake and Jesus, that nothing could be further from the truth, and that Blake, Blake is constantly in dialogue with the Bible. He knows the scriptures better almost than anyone else, and they're living for him in an extraordinary way. But he's very drawn to and has some remarkable things to say about the figure of Jesus, although he has a very strong attack on what he sees as the false image of what he calls the creeping Jesus, the false Jesus, meek and mild. He sees Jesus as a glorious and resplendent energy and a connection between heaven and earth, and ultimately calls him the divine body, the human imagination. Extraordinary things he has to say about Jesus. So I want to talk about that in the third session. And then in the fourth session, finally, on the 23rd, I'll talk about Blake as prophet. And then the day after that final session, on that Tuesday, the 23rd, I have arranged, and I'll need to get numbers a bit beforehand just to let them know, I have arranged for a special expedition for us as a group to the Fitzwilliam Museum. I'm afraid the only time I could get was during during the daytime, so I don't know. I mean, I'm not encouraging anybody to pull a sickie, but the fact is that it's going to be at 2 o'clock, but it's going to be wonderful. So if you can possibly be there, you know, let me know. So that gives you a little bit of the overall shape of what I'm going to try and do. I'm going to try nobly this time to stop in time for us to have a little bit of feedback. I'm afraid I'm going to have to race on these because this has been moved from a Wednesday to a Tuesday, and Tuesday is a college night for me, and I have to be up at Girton at 7. So I'm going to have to sort of get on my bike, as the saying is, pretty much at 6:30. So let's begin then with this general introduction and overview. So just to place Blake in history, his biographer Peter Ackroyd, who's, I think Ackroyd's biography is very fine and highly readable, points out that actually placing Blake in history is always a difficult thing to do because, you know, you can say he was born in 1757 and he died in 1827, and that's a useful thing to know. So you can see him going right through the second half of the 18th century, that he's born right in the midst of, you know, what sometimes people think of as an Augustan, a neoclassical age, an age of restraint, reason, reasonableness, an age which shrank from enthusiasm, an age which diminished imagination, an age which was concerned to produce as rational a view of the world as possible. You can say all that stuff, and then you can see how he lives on into the reaction against that, the Romantic era, and some people see him as anticipating the Romantics, others disagree. So you can place him in that historical context, and it's a proper thing to do, except that Blake so constantly speaks of all time and all space at every era being simultaneously present, and simultaneously present to his mind, and potentially simultaneously present to our minds. And Blake is so constantly concerned with the transcendence of time and space, and, as it were, looking at things, as the old theologians would have said, sub specie aeternitatis, that is, as it were, from the standpoint of vision and heaven, that sometimes you think he is timeless, that he happened to be moving about upon the surface of the earth between these years, but actually the content of what he had to deliver doesn't seem to have been, as it were, conditioned by the the time and place that he was living in quite the same way that other people's were. Although he's alive to it, he's alert to it, he's dealing with contemporary issues, as we'll see in the Songs of Innocence and Experience. He's very strongly campaigning against slavery. He's looking at the lot of children. He's looking for social justice, and so on. But he's also delivering things that just seem to be timeless. So, but let's be biographical for a minute, and we'll say that he was born in 1757 in Broad Street, which is in Soho. It's not called Broad Street anymore. It's called Broadacre or something like that. Anyway, he was the son of a hosier who was a sort of, you know, artisan, probably, you know, I mean, better off than the poorest of the poor, and, you know, having his own premises and a real craftsman making stockings and gloves and woolen work. And it would have been a cottage industry where Blake would have, you know, his parents would have been working and his brothers and sisters while he was growing up. He was eventually apprenticed. They saw his ability to draw and his sense of colour and picture very early on, and he was apprenticed to an engraver, eventually went to the Royal Academy of Art, fell out with both the engraver and the Royal Academy of Art in a pretty major way, and set up as far as he could as an independent engraver and artisan. Lived a very, very precarious life, pretty much on the edge of poverty, and eventually, towards the end of his life, in deep poverty and obscurity. He did literally die penniless, in the sense that he actually spent his last shilling on pencils to keep drawing the fantastic and beautiful illustrations to Dante's Divine Comedy, which he was working on. When he died singing. He laid aside the pencil. Just before he laid aside the pencil, he called in Catherine, his wife, and they'd been married. You know, they had a long, and I think happy marriage. Unconventional in its own way, and some people have recently written things to suggest that maybe it was very unconventional, and, you know, maybe some of Blake's free love theories were being put into a bit of practice, but it seems to have been faithful in its own terms. It was unconventional in the sense that sometimes people calling on the Blakes would find them both completely naked and sort of sitting in their armchairs, you know, in their little, when asked, they would say that they'd been keeping company with Adam and Eve, and since Adam and Eve weren't dressed, they didn't see why they should be. So you know, you can imagine in sort of late 18th century, some people found that slightly hard to handle. But having said that, you know, it was a very close and intimate relationship, and one of the very last things that Blake did was to call Catherine through with this pencil he spent his last thing on, and draw her picture, which is sadly now lost, the last drawing that he did. And he said, "I'm going to draw you because I see the angel in you already. You know, you've always been my angel," he said. And he drew her as an angel. And then he said, "I'm going to that land which I've always loved and always seen." You know, so he was very... And when she died some years later, she was perfectly clear that she could see him and that he was calling. You know, so they were... That sense of the veil, as it were, between earth and heaven was almost completely transparent by the end of Blake's life. And some people found that hard to handle. He would be talking to people that they couldn't see and so on. And of course, the consequence of all of that was that a lot of people simply thought he was mad. And I've got no doubt that had he been born in our era, he would have been categorised and medicalised and probably chemically coshed and pushed into, and assume we would have found some labels for him in order to avoid hearing what he had to say. And that may be the fate even in our own day of some William Blakes amongst us. He was thought to be mad, but interestingly, unlike Christopher Smart, whom I talked about in one of these sessions before, who was thought to be mad, Christopher Smart was confined to Bedlam. Blake never was. And Wordsworth, to give him credit, although he said he'd heard of Blake and he took a look at Blake's poem Jerusalem and could make head nor tail of it, and he said, "He is completely mad." But then he said, "But there is something that draws me. I find greater interest in Blake's madness than I do in the sanity of Byron or Scott," which was quite an interesting kind of concession from Wordsworth. The much more significant meeting with one of the otherwise well-known greats, which has been really very little written about, and which I would like to write about with time and leisure allowed in much more details. There was an astonishing meeting, which I'll tell you a bit more about in a minute, between Blake and Coleridge when Blake was a very old man, and a chap called Tolk, who was a Swedenborgian and who loved Coleridge's works, actually got the two of them together. And we have some notes of the conversation. I think that's particularly significant because at the core of Blake's vision was a restoration of the imagination as absolutely core to understanding what reality is, rather than as a means of escaping from reality. And, of course, that was absolutely the core of Coleridge's vision. And, in fact, later on in Coleridge's life, Coleridge came to relate that very strongly to the Trinity and to think about the Logos and Christ as, in some sense, the imagination in us. But Blake had got there years before him, almost intuitively, when he spoke of Jesus, the imagination. So he was known about, but not really rated. People thought that he was mad. He died in comparative poverty. In fact, he would have died earlier, probably, and we would not have had the great Dante illustrations or the Gospel illustrations or the astonishing etchings and engravings for the Book of Job had it not been for a little group of visionary artists who had nowhere else to go and who were feeling that the sort of the tyranny of a kind of entirely this-worldly, very meticulously observed, but in a sense opaque kind of art where you just draw what you see and you don't draw anything through it. You know, you draw the window, but you don't draw what you've seen through the window, as it were. That was the way art was going, and there's a little group of people who called themselves the Ancients, borrowing a phrase actually from one of Blake's, among whom was John Linnell and then Samuel Palmer, about whom I've preached from this pulpit. They discovered Blake when he was an old man living at Fountain Court, and they called his little flat in Fountain Court the House of the Interpreter, borrowing a phrase from Bunyan. And they came, and Palmer was poor himself, but just fell in love with Blake and with everything that Blake was doing. And Palmer's whole vision as an artist, which we now appreciate very much, you know, the brilliant pictures like the Magic Apple Tree, which I've taken some of you to see in the Fitzwilliam, you know, would never have been made had these very young men not found this obscure old man dying in Fountain Court. Luckily, Linnell had contacts with richer patrons and managed to get Blake the commissions and give the commissions himself to do the Dante and the Book of Job. And the money from that is what kept Blake and Catherine alive for their last years. So there was a kind of... I think he did get some inkling when he was dying that it wasn't, you know, that in this world people would eventually understand him and would eventually see what he was on about. And he had the sense of seeing that he had actually inspired a younger generation. And then, of course, eventually there was a life of him by a chap called Gilchrist, which inspired interest and particularly interest of the poet Yeats. And Yeats really championed him, and it's really as much as anything through Yeats that Blake came out of obscurity and came to be known more widely. So, that's a little bit of frame. I want to talk about Blake as a visionary. Gilchrist, who's the first source we have, the kind of earliest life of Blake, but other writers since, using Blake's own letters and obviously the poetry and things that were told about him by those who'd known him, stories he'd told about himself, says that he saw visions from very early on. And when I say he saw visions, I mean it's what they call eidetic vision. That he, it's not that he kind of went into a dreamy state and made things up, but that he would sometimes startlingly see something that other people simply couldn't see, but which he could describe in minute detail and draw. And people would say, well, you know, a modern psychological view would be to think about that in terms of delusions or possibly in terms of, you know, psychosis, and assume that what we're dealing with is a mental projection mistaken for reality. The thing, though, is that Blake himself is clearly so completely sane and sensible in all these other aspects of his life. I mean, he ran a small business, you know, he kept his books and accounts, he functioned perfectly well in society, apart from what people thought was these private eccentricities about clothes and things like that. So, you know, it's a bit difficult to do that. Let me just tell you some of the things that Blake claims he saw, even as a child. I mean, as a very young child, he said he saw the face of God, you know. As a, you know, when we're talking about four or five. But when he was a boy, I think probably about eight or nine, he was walking, they lived in central London, but Blake loved walking and would walk out, and he's walking out towards Peckham, and he saw a tree full of angels. You know, the tree was there, and he could simply see these angels shining in the tree. And there's another really interesting thing, which is a thing that really moved Samuel Palmer, and Samuel Palmer came to paint, that coming home late in harvest time, as the sun was setting, and from the fact that some may have said, I think maybe the moon was out, that there were the gleaners and the reapers in the harvest field working among the sheaves. And Blake says he saw angels walking beside them through the harvest fields. So he would see things like that. So he had vision in that sense. But he was a visionary in another sense, in that he was constantly looking for the depth or the truth or the meaning behind what you see. He referred to the actual, he was interested in, he certainly looked at Newton's optics and was pretty familiar with, you know, he was a very intelligent man, and he'd read a lot of the contemporary philosophy of his day in terms of Newton and Locke and Hume, and was familiar with what they said. And what they said was very reductive. They said the mind is a tabula rasa, it's just a blank thing. Light comes in through the eye and then it forms images, and they weren't quite sure how the images work, but they imagined the images coming at the back, and then we have strings of association and we construct a self out of that. And it's that kind of thinking. And all that system of interaction at a purely physical level, Blake wasn't denying that that kind of thing happened, but he wasn't simply saying that that's not what's really going on. So he called that way of looking, he called it the vegetative eye. And he said, I no more consult my vegetative eye for truth than I have a conversation with a window about what's beyond it. You know, I don't look at, I look through. The window is not going to tell me what is there. I have to look through the window. And everything that comes in as a piece of information processed in my brain through the nerves in the back of my eye, that isn't going to tell me anything at all, any more than the window is going to tell me something. I have to look through and not at or just with. So he was a visionary in that sense, that he was concerned with looking through. And when, towards the end of his life, he wrote the notes for his own, some of his own paintings. His note, he wrote a great painting called A Vision of Judgment. And somebody wanted an explanatory note, and he said, what, it will be exclaimed, when the sun rises, a man will say to you, do you not see a round disk of fire, somewhat the size of a guinea? You must reply, no, no, no. I see the innumerable hosts of heaven crying, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. Now, he's not saying that we don't have the experience ocularly of a round disk of fire, somewhat the size of a guinea. But he says if that's what we're seeing, then we're not seeing right. In fact, his view of what vision is, and particularly his understanding of the relationship between what we think of as the outer, supposedly dead, quote-unquote, objective material world out there, the stuff we do our science on and weigh and measure, and the inward, supposedly separate, private little soul that, you know, is somehow accidentally here and is this little thing in our head that somehow floatingly holds all our values, yeah? But the real stuff, which is totally neutral and dead and objective, is out there. He rejected that entire view. I mean, absolutely and completely. And so completely that he never seems to have actually had it, you know, in spite of the fact he was brought into a world that thought and felt like that. His view was that children don't think like that at all. Children have, has to be drubbed into children to stop thinking in another way, and they have to be taught to think that the world is dead and meaningless and that they can do stuff to it, you know. And he seems to have never lost that childlike vision. But he did reflect on it philosophically, and I'd like, just while we're thinking about vision, to just look at something I've put right at the beginning of the extracts I've given you. This is an extract from a very strange book, often quoted, I think often misquoted, called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And it has Proverbs of Heaven and Proverbs of Hell, and it has things called a memorable fancy, and it's got all kinds of... It's a very strange work. There are some plates from it here on one of these sheets. There. But it starts with some kind of principles, and I just want to give you three, which seems to me, this is quite an early work of Blake's, to kind of animate. And in fact, you kind of bear them in mind for everything else we say. And they're, as they would have said in the 60s, they're pretty mind-blowing. First comes, principle number one, is a total challenge to dualism, to a dualistic way of thinking of body, soul, matter, spirit, subject, object. That whole way, which since Descartes, we split the world up. Which is a really comparatively recent development. It's not the mythological way of thinking that most human beings have had for most of the time. This is what he says. Man has no body distinct from his soul. For that called body is a portion of soul discerned by the five senses, the chief inlet of soul in this age. Now just think about that for a minute. Blake is saying that the five senses, which are your only way of getting hold of what, you know, is supposedly out there. So this is your sight and your sense and your touch and your smell. He doesn't say that those are inlets of physical stuff that you can then do something spiritual with if you feel like it on the inside. He says the five senses are the inlet of soul. So he's actually saying everything out there that you see is soul. The sun and moon and the stars and the green growing things and other people's bodies and your own body and all those things that you perceive with your senses are spiritual. They are spiritual. And you mustn't confine consciousness and awareness and value and beauty and life and all of those things that you think are islanded privately in human subjectivity. He says they're all actually all the time, all the way out there surrounding you. And what you get when you look at the world is, yes, you see physical things and you construct them in a certain way, and that's great. But what you're seeing is soul. It's a pretty extraordinary thing to say. And soul is clearly therefore, so there's nobody distinct from soul. Then he goes, energy is the only life and is from the body, and reason, now we've talked, is the bound or outward circumference of energy. Isn't that extraordinary? I mean, we don't get all of Blake. I'm not sure any of us really get this. What does it mean to say that reason is the bound or outward circumference of energy? Obviously, reason is very much about drawing boundaries and lines. I might say something from one of Blake's letters that might help you to understand this phrase, reason is the bound or outwards. Blake wrote a great deal about what he called the bounding line. He was trained rigorously. He had a 7-year apprenticeship as an engraver on copper, okay? So you don't want to make mistakes with that. You know, copper is not a medium in which you do lots of little fine shading and grading and little stipples and dips. You know, if you draw a line, you want it to be the line you mean. And Blake loved outlines. He thought making outlines was really important. And, you know, you can see that from his art. And he, use the word bounding, which is a very interesting word. I remember when I was a student in the late 70s hearing hearing Geoffrey Hill lecturing on Blake in this university, giving a great lecture on the bounding line. And he pointed out a really simple thing, that Blake's use of the word bounding, the word bounding is a gloriously paradoxical word. Or on the one hand, bounding is about binding. It's about bounding something in, bounding and boundaries. But on the other hand, we use the word bounding to describe energetic movement, bounding along. We talk about, you know, grace abounding, abundance. There's a kind of sense in which, paradoxically, that which limits is also that which gives force and fierceness and energy. Does that make sense? That so the bounding. If you think about reason as a circumference, so you're saying reason draws some lines, okay, and they may be good lines for reason to draw. But what reason is doing is concentrating an energy, which is more than reason. And later on in his work, he comes to think about what that energy might be in terms of imagination and in terms of God's life within us. Okay, so it's not that he has no place for reason. But to call reason a circumference is a very different thing from thinking of reason as in the way that it was thought of in Blake's own time. Energy is eternal delight is the third thing. So that's just a little, we're getting ahead of ourselves here. That's just a little bit of his sense of vision. The five senses are the inlet of soul. Reason is a circumference. Now, one thing that all the books say, and they always say it in the same way about Blake, and it's always, books about Blake are inevitably written by academics who have had the benefit of a good school and a good university education, and have therefore been schooled, they've often been to Oxford or Cambridge, and they've all therefore been schooled in a particular way. And of course, one of the things that they discover as they start writing their lives of Blake is that Blake never went to university, and in fact never went to school. And yet, you know, he is obviously a total genius, and he's very, very widely read. And they have a word, which is always the same word that's used by academics writing about brilliant non-academics. And the word is, they say, Blake was an autodidact. What they mean is he's self-taught, which is an astonishing thing. But isn't it interesting that when academics want to say that somebody is self-taught, they have to say it in Greek? Autodidact, that's what self-taught is, in Greek. Now, why do they do that? It's almost as though they're still wanting to keep the barrier. They're still wanting to do a kind of us and them thing. Do you know, he's an autodidact. It's extraordinary how he manages it. You know. Now, the fact that Blake was an autodidact is really important. Obviously, it shows, you know, courage and energy and determination. There are two sides to that. One side, there are lots of great writers who've been self-taught, who've been autodidacts. And sometimes it means that the brilliant side of it is it means they're completely free and original thinkers. They haven't been told, they haven't had it drummed into them by endless sixth-form essays, what it is they're supposed to say, or what it is that they're supposed to think, or which two writers go together and which two writers don't go together, or what suits that period and what doesn't suit that period. So they haven't had their options limited by people who want them to pass exams. And that sometimes means that they have a brilliant new approach and they have great ideas. On the other hand, they haven't been taught, you know, simple arts of summary, the way of cogently putting things, you know, absolute clarity so that the poor marker of your essay on the 65th essay and the 7th cup of coffee will still get it. So, and autodidacts generally tend to be completely in love with language because language is deliriously lovable. And they use lots of long words and string long sentences together, and, you know, The style of writing an autodidact can actually sometimes be seen to a person who's had a university kind of unnecessarily obscure. But actually, that floridness and wordiness is sometimes not obscurity. It's a kind of act of love, really. It's people wanting to draw all these things. So there are some difficult sides of reading books by people who haven't, as it were, had that official schooling in the world of books. But there are brilliant compensations. And the most brilliant of all is that they can come to a set of notions that we've taken for granted and just completely open them up. because they've not been taught to take them for granted. But in the case of Blake, it's not simply that, quote unquote, he didn't have the opportunity to go to university. It's much more serious than that. It's that by the time he had worked out from his own perspective what was being taught in the universities and how and why it was being taught, he not only was glad that he didn't go, but he launched a huge attack on the whole educational system, which is not what autodidacts are supposed to do. You know, from the point of the people, in view of the people inside the educational system, they ought to be jolly glad that we recognise that they're really quite good in spite of having gone to the same, not gone to our school. But I'd like just briefly, if we turn over from the handout to give you, just to give you, have I put it here? Oh, perhaps I haven't given it to you. I was going to give you a wonderful passage in which he, we'll have a look at that, in which he says, I turn my eyes to the universities of Europe. And it's a pretty excoriating and terrible condemnation. Well, we'll save that for when we talk about Blake as prophet, see what he actually has to say about Oxford and Cambridge. In his day, of course, they might be different now. I'm sorry, I thought I'd got that in my hand there, but I haven't. He had his apprenticeship, he went to and left the Royal Academy, and he set about living by his art and by his writing, a precarious living. The very first original piece of work that we have from Blake, which is quite early, still in his apprenticeship, most of the apprenticeship was spent copying great masters and making nice, you know, printable plates so that other people could see the great masters, which is a fabulous training for the eye and the hand. But when, maybe age 15 or 16, he was allowed to do what he liked for one picture, what he actually did was Joseph of Arimathea among the rocks of Albion. Extraordinary thing. He fastened on the Glastonbury legend, the story that perhaps Arimathea, Joseph of Arimathea had, not only that he had brought the Grail, supposedly, to England, and that Glastonbury Abbey had been founded when he planted his staff, but the earlier story that perhaps the child Jesus had come with Joseph, who was believed by tradition to have been a merchant, sailing with the Phoenician sailors, who did indeed trade. I mean, there was a regular trade from Palestine to Cornwall for tin, so there were Phoenician coasters. I mean, there was actual communication in the time of Christ by sea between the British Isles and Palestine. It wasn't, and it's a fantasy if you like, but it's not an entirely impossible one. And the story, you know, the legend was that the Christ child had come to England, and that Arimathea had remembered this, and when in the terrible destruction fell and the destruction of Jerusalem and the total persecution of all the Christians, that he had taken the hallows, the spear, and the of Longinus and the Grail, and gone back to that place that he himself had taken Christ. And the earliest thing that we have of Blake is, and Blake saying, Joseph of Arimathea among the hills of Albion, using this old quasi-mythical word for the British Isles. Albion became hugely important as a word for him as he developed. And of course, we all know the bit of Blake that everybody knows, which we sing as Jerusalem, but is actually from a poem called Milton, and it's not in the poem Jerusalem. He asks that question openly, and did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green? And was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills? And that image of Christ as a child, radiant in the midst of the hills of the place where he felt Albion was destroying itself. He felt he wrote in the end a great allegorical poem, also called Jerusalem, a long poem which we'll look at in the final session, in which Albion, representing all of us, humanity, but humanity particularly in these islands, who has turned aside from the divine child into what he calls in that poem the wastes of the moral law. into a kind of judgmental, hypocritical, divisive, oppressive, false religion in which children and women in particular are crushed. And Blake was very sensitive to what was going on in the machinery of religion and state. And in his poem, Albion, personified, finally comes back to Christ and says to him, O divine imagination, O human body, whom I have crucified, and recovers. And Albion is saved. That's to anticipate. But from the earliest thing that Blake ever did was this picture of Joseph of Arimathea. So he did his best to make a living, but wasn't entirely successful at it. But in the course of it, I suppose the works that we would now think of, there's The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, from which I've already quoted. There's The Songs of Innocence, and then The Songs of Experience, which are the most widely accessible. And then there are a series of what are called the prophetic books, for which Blake kind of developed almost his own mythology in a bit of a similar way to the way that Tolkien did, but kind of less accessibly, and created a series of characters, Your Reason and Loss and others. But he related these prophecies to contemporary political events. There's a book called America, A Prophecy. There's a book on France. He was really fascinated by the French and the American revolutions. He had great hopes of both. He was a radical character who wanted to see the manacles and chains lifted from people. But he saw very rapidly how the real revolution, which he wanted to happen, together with the lifting of political oppression, he wanted the lifting of personal and sexual oppression, he wanted a complete liberation from within, and he wanted ultimately a radical change of consciousness and a complete rethinking of our aims and goals and the way we related to nature and to each other. And he felt that was on the verge of happening in both of those revolutions, and then it didn't. And actually, he predicted, well, he saw it happen in France, and he predicted it in America, that both of these supposedly liberated places would indeed carry on with their weapons industries, would become oppressive empires, and would fall back into wearing themselves and putting onto each other and onto others the mind-forged manacles. And that's exactly what happened. But he never lost hope, and he was trying by his prophecy and by his writings to, as he put it, to cleanse the doors of perception. And at this point, it's probably worth looking again at the sheet I gave you, to where Blake himself, you know, in modern parlance, gives his mission statement, as it were, which is in the poem Jerusalem. There's some things he says about Jesus that I want to turn to later, but let me look at the passage that begins, I see the fourfold man. This, I think, is getting to the core of what Blake thought he was put on earth to do. I see the fourfold man, the humanity, in a deadly sleep, and its fallen emanation, the spectre and its cruel shadow. He speaks a lot about emanations and shadows in a language that massively anticipates the writings of Carl Jung. And Jung, of course, is very interested in it. But he thought a lot of what we think of ourselves as ourselves is actually a projection or a shadow of ourselves. And we spend a lot of time serving our shadows and emanations rather than centering on who we really are in the divine love, if that makes sense. So I see the fourfold man, the humanity in deadly sleep, the fallen emanation, the spectre and its cruel shadow. I see the past, present and future existing all at once. That's the kind of thing Blake says all the time, which is why it makes it very difficult to sort of put Blake in his social context, if you take that seriously. Before me, all at once before me, O divine spirit, sustain me on thy wings, that I may awake Albion from his long and cold repose. So Blake's writing from first to last is meant to be a wake-up call. And my view is that The reason why Blake, who died as obscurity, in complete obscurity, is becoming more and more known, and here you all are, you know, probably more people than Blake himself ever had listening to him in one room at one time, is that we are gradually waking up. But we're not fully awake yet, so we haven't got it yet. Then he goes on to say what it is he's trying to do. And I think it's a wonderful picture of Blake. You've got to think of Blake in this unheated room, you know, candle lit, you know, not being able to afford the fuel for the fire, you know, but burning lots of candles to have sufficient light to do this job that he feels he's been put on earth to do. Trembling, I sit day and night. My friends are astonished at me. They were astonished. And lots of them gave up on him, you know, because he was just too strong. My friends are astonished at me, yet they forgive my wanderings. I rest not from my great task. Okay, here it comes. To open the eternal worlds, to open the immortal eyes of man, inward to the worlds of thought, into eternity, ever expanding in the bosom of God, the human imagination. O Saviour, pour upon me thy spirit of meekness and love, annihilate the selfhood in me. Be thou all my life. Now, I've heard lots of people saying Blake is anti-religion and anti-religious, and you know, you can't, what's a Christian priest doing talking about William Blake? Isn't he some kind of New Age mystic? I recognize complete continuity in that statement with all the great Christian mystics. It is absolutely central, everything that he's saying there. And I think Blake is not an isolated one-off. I think he's part of a great tradition of mystics and prophets that God raises up in order to wake us up. So just after that, I put his message to the Christians from the book Jerusalem. We'll look at the book Jerusalem in the final session. And he's got a message to the Christians, a message to the Jews, a message to the Muslims, and a message to the atheists in that book. He's got quite interesting. I mean, it's all pretty relevant to what's going on in the world now. Anyway, of course, everybody wants to read the message to the other people and say, oh, you should do something about that. I'm going to concentrate on the message to the Christians, and this is part of it. I know of no other Christianity and of no other gospel than the liberty both of body and mind to exercise the divine arts of imagination. Imagination, the real and eternal world, of which this vegetable universe is but a faint shadow, and in which we shall live in our eternal or imaginative bodies when these vegetable mortal bodies are no more. Pretty extraordinary stuff. So that's Blake's agenda. And I think to some degree it is also the church's agenda. And I suppose I want to close by saying this. Lots of people, since that day he died in obscurity, mainly in the 20th century, have championed him. Yeats, Kathleen Rain from my own college, who in her great book, Blake and the Tradition, showed that there's a long tradition of mystics and Blake is part of that. Shows he's not just an isolated genius. But Kathleen Rain is certainly not seeing herself as part of the Orthodox or organized church. She'd see herself as a much wider kind of spirituality, what she calls the perennial philosophy. Northrop Frye, the great literary critic who wrote A Fearful Symmetry and showed Blake's astonishing relevance to understanding literature and art today, and wrote The Great Code, following Blake's hints about how to read the Bible. Ginsberg, I've mentioned. Dylan uses Blake continuously. In fact, if you happen to be around tomorrow evening, I'm going to be doing an On the Edge service here based on Dylan's new album, The Tempest. And he does the most amazing thing with Blake's Tiger on that. He takes a couple of the lines of Tiger and then inserts a couple of other lines in an amazing song about John Lennon. So Dylan does it. Van Morrison, full of Blake. Lots of people like that. The only people I see not noticing Blake and saying nothing about him are the very people to whom he addressed the message, and that is the Christian church. And it may be that it's tough. Maybe we just can't take the criticism. Maybe the fact that he wrote so pertinently, you know, I went to the Garden of Love and I saw what I never had seen. You know, a chapel was built in the midst where I used to play on the green, and the gates of that chapel were shut, and thou shalt not writ over the door, and priests in black gowns were walking their rounds and binding with briars my joys and desires. You know, maybe that's the kind of criticism from which we haven't recovered yet. Maybe because it was true. But I actually think that Blake holds the key to a renewal of spiritual vision both within the church and beyond. So fairly unapologetically, in the next sessions on the Innocence and Experience, in which I will look at the just criticism of the church, and then in the final two sessions on Blake and Jesus and Blake and Prophecy, I'm going to try pretty unashamedly to say, what is it that Christianity and the church has to learn from Blake? What ought we to be listening to? And how might some of the things that he say fit with some of the things that we say? I'm not claiming Blake as Mr. Orthodoxy. I'm not saying that everything he ever uttered can be squeezed into the Nicene Creed. Far from it. But I am saying that this guy is dealing with the same reality with which we're dealing and is a gifted visionary. And if he can cleanse the doors of our perception, we ought to let him do it. Okay, I'm going to stop there. We've got about 5 minutes for any responses. Thank you so much, all of you, for coming and listening for so long. Thank you.